The gods of heaven and earth of the ancient Near East not only originated in the heavens, but could also return to the heavenly abode. Realizing that such two-way travel between earth and the heavenly abode were practiced, the people of Sumer did not exile their gods to distant galaxies. The abode of the gods, their legacy discloses, was within our own solar system. An Assyrian depiction of the gateway of Anu in the heavenly abode confirms ancient familiarity with a celestial system such as our sun and its planets. The Sumerians steadfastly held to the opinion that in addition to the planets known to us today, there has been a 12th member of the solar system, the home planet of the Nephilim. We shall call it the 12th planet. The Sumerians were the first to divide the heavens into three bands or ways, the northern way, which was named after Enlil, the southern after Ea, and the central band was the way of Anu. The present-day central band, the band of the 12 constellations of the zodiac, corresponds exactly to the way of Anu, in which the Sumerian grouped the stars into 12 houses. Because the constellations and their subdivisions and even individual stars within the constellations have reached Western civilization with names and descriptions borrowed heavily from Greek mythology, the Western world tended for nearly two millennia to credit the Greeks with this achievement. But it's now apparent that the early Greek astronomers merely adopted into their language and mythology a ready-made astronomy attained from the Sumerians. The shift from one zodiacal house to another takes more than two millennia. Professor Langdon's findings revealed that the Nepurian calendar, established around 4400 BC in the age of Taurus, reflects knowledge of precession. Professor H. V. Hilbert concluded that the number 12,960,000, on which the mathematical astronomical calculations were based, showed that the Sumerians knew the length of the great year, that it would be 25,920 Earth years. Now this is indeed fantastic astronomical sophistication at an impossible time. The Sumerians referred to all celestial bodies as mule, who shine in the heights, but some mules were termed lubad, clearly designating planets in our solar system. The texts leave no doubt our solar system was made up of 12 members. It included, in addition to the planets known to us, also the planet of Anu, the planet of the supreme scepter. We can now grasp the significance of the number 12 in the ancient world. The great circle of Sumerian gods, and of all Olympian gods thereafter, comprised exactly 12. Younger gods could join the circle only if older gods retired. Likewise, a vacancy had to be filled to retain the divine number 12. The principal celestial circle, the way of the sun with its 12 members, set the pattern, according to which each other celestial band was divided into 12 segments or was allocated 12 principal celestial bodies. Accordingly, there were 12 months in a year, 12 double hours in a day. Each division of Sumer was assigned 12 celestial bodies as a measure of good luck. Many studies show that the division of the year into 12 months was, from its very beginnings, related to the 12 great gods. The number 12 permeated all matters, celestial and divine, long after the Sumerians were gone. There were 12 Greek titans, 12 tribes of Israel, and the 12 apostles of Jesus. Where did this powerful, decisive number 12 stem from? From the heavens. Teaching humanity the true nature of Earth and the heavens, the Nephilim informed the ancient astronomer priest not only of the planets beyond Saturn, but also of the existence of the most important planet, the one from which they came, the 12th planet. And now we reach the climax of our search for answers to primeval celestial events, the existence of a 12th planet. Astonishing as it may sound, our astronomers have been looking for evidence that indeed such a planet once existed between Mars and Jupiter. Toward the end of the 18th century, even before Neptune had been discovered, several astronomers demonstrated that the planets were placed at certain distances from the Sun according to some definite law. The suggestion, which came to be known as Bode's Law, convinced astronomers that a planet ought to revolve in a place where hitherto no planet had been known to exist, that is, between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Spurred by these mathematical calculations, astronomers began to scan the skies in the indicated zone for the missing planet. On the first day of the 19th century, the Italian astronomer Giuseppe Piazzi discovered at the exact indicated distance a very small planet, 485 miles across, which he named Ceres. By 1804, the number of asteroids, small planets, found there rose to four. To date, nearly 3,000 asteroids have been counted orbiting the Sun and what is now called the asteroid belt. Beyond any doubt, this is the debris of a planet that had shattered to pieces. Russian astronomers have named it Phaeton. While astronomers are certain that such a planet existed, they're unable to explain its disappearance. Did the planet self-explode? But then its pieces would have flown off in all directions and not stayed in a single belt. If a collision shattered the missing planet, where is the celestial body responsible for that collision? Did it also shatter? But the debris circling the Sun, when added up, is insufficient to account for even one whole planet, to say nothing of two. Also, if the asteroids comprise the debris of two planets, they should have retained the axial revolution of two planets. But all the asteroids have a single axial rotation, indicating that they come from a single celestial body. How then was the missing planet shattered, and what shattered it? About a century ago, the decipherment of the text found in Mesopotamia unexpectedly grew into a realization that there, in Mesopotamia, text existed that not only paralleled but also preceded portions of the Holy Scripture. Now called the Creation Epic, the text tells us that two primeval celestial bodies gave birth to a series of celestial gods. As the number of celestial beings increased, they made great noise and commotion, disturbing the primeval father. His faithful messenger urged him to take strong measures to discipline the young gods, but they ganged up on him and robbed him of his creative powers. The primeval mother sought to take revenge. The god who led the revolt against the primeval father had a new suggestion. Let his young son be invited to join the assembly of gods and be given supremacy so that he might go fight single-handedly the monster their mother turned out to be. Granted supremacy, the young god, Marduk, proceeded to face the monster, and after a fierce battle vanquished her and split her in two. Of one part of her he made heaven, and of the other, earth. He then proclaimed a fixed order in the heavens, assigning to each celestial god a permanent position. On earth he produced the mountains and seas and rivers, established the seasons and vegetation, and created man. In duplication of the heavenly abode, Babylon and its towering temple were built on earth. Gods and mortals were given assignments and commandments, rituals to be followed. The gods then proclaimed Marduk, the supreme deity. As more tablets and fragments were found and translated, it became evident that the text was not a simple literary work. It was the most hallowed historical religious epic of Babylon, read as part of the New Year rituals. There's enough evidence here to show that the Babylonian version of the epic was a masterful religious-political forgery of early Sumerian versions, in which Anu, Enlil, and Ninurta were the heroes. No matter, however, what the actors in this celestial and divine drama were called, the tale is certainly as ancient as Sumerian civilization. Most scholars see it as a philosophic work, the earliest version of the eternal struggle between good and evil, or the allegorical tale of nature's winter and summer, sunrise and sunset, death and resurrection. But why not take the epic at face value as nothing more nor less than the statement of the cosmologic facts as known to the Sumerians, as told to them by the Nephilim? Using such a bold and novel approach, we find that the epic of creation perfectly explains the events that probably took place in our solar system. Tiamat was the monster that Marduk later shattered, the missing planet. The authors of the creation epic raised the curtain on a drama of celestial turmoil. The approach of Marduk began to disturb Tiamat. He produced streams. The gods were not at rest, carried as in a storm. The gods decreed Marduk's destiny. Their combined gravitational pull determined Marduk's orbital path so that he could go but one way, toward a battle, a collision, with Tiamat. Subjected to the conflicting gravitational pulls, the large satellite of Tiamat began to shift toward Marduk. The die was cast. The courses irrevocably set on collision. Tiamat emitted a roar. As Marduk came even closer, Tiamat's fury grew. The roots of her legs shook back and forth. She commenced to cast spells against Marduk, but Marduk kept coming at her. They approached for battle. But the two planets did not collide, a fact of cardinal astronomical importance. It was the satellites of Marduk that smashed into Tiamat, and not Marduk himself. The first encounter between Marduk and Tiamat left her fissured and lifeless, but her final fate was still to be determined by future encounters between the two. It is here that the biblical tale of Genesis joins the Mesopotamian epic of creation, for it is not only at this point that the tale of the creation of earth and heaven really begins. Completing her first ever orbit around the sun, Marduk then returned to Tiamat, whom he had subdued. Marduk himself now hit the defeated planet, splitting Tiamat in two. Then another of Marduk's satellites,